on this episode of The Commercial Break.
Rachel Bloom is an accomplished writer, director, actor, and comedian. With hit TV shows like My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Reboot, Julia, and the Muppets musical to her credits, Rachel is a force of musical comedic neuroses. And now she can add TCB Guest as her entertainment Everest moment. I'm almost certain she would agree with that sentiment. Right? Wouldn't you, Rachel? We'll add her links in the show notes. One more thing. She's got the greatest name in the history of the world, and she spells it correctly. Here's your first guest and your second episode of TCB's Endless Day. It starts now.
The next episode of The Commercial Break starts now.
Where in the world is Rachel Bloom?
I'm in my office in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
My dog just threw up on the lawn.
Oh.
As she does.
Yep.
All the time.
Because she's eating grass?
No.
Just because she throws up?
She's 15 and a half and her stomach is a mess.
Aww.
She's allergic to chicken and her stomach is getting, and we don't give her chicken, but her stomach's getting more and more sensitive by the day. And it's fine.
Oh, you know, you talk a lot about your dogs and how much you love them, especially in your new special, which is great, by the way.
Thank you.
So do you find that being a parent and having a dog changes the dynamic a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, especially in the beginning, dogs are way better with their bodies, especially a full-grown dog. A dog has better body awareness. When you have a newborn, your dog is a genius. Like, oh, yes. My God, I don't have to worry about my dog breathing. The right. Dog is so smart. And then I think what's interesting
is... I don't have to worry about my dog breathing.
And then they start to, you know, even out. This thing is, kids get maybe smart like dogs, but they're still bad with their like bodies and walking. So really around like 2.5, 3, you're like, okay, the dog and the kid are basically equal in their kind of sense of the world. Although, look, the dog is more physically intelligent than I am.
Yes.
Even though she's 80 in dog years, she can traverse stairs.
Oh, right.
Balance is still way better. So I think that there's a general, she goes from being like, the dog went from being my daughter's big sister to now seeming like her little sister.
Ah, that's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah.
But yeah, the dog was the queen of the house until the children showed up, and she has taken it so gracefully, but there is no other place to go but down when the child comes, because now children and dogs are so much alike. Children and puppies are so much alike. But in another way, the dog can take care of itself. I can leave the dog for a couple of hours. I can't leave the child for a couple of hours. And so you really find that you're so much more attentive to the children than you are to the dog.
You have to be. Otherwise, the child will die.
Yeah, like, the child dies.
Yeah. You literally have to be. My husband was very mindful to not do a Lady and the Tramp situation and have our dog be neglected when our daughter was born. So he was really mindful at including the dog, and she's still very much our princess. And then, I mean, you know, for me, I can't dote on the dog as much, but I don't know. We're pretty, because also she's old.
Yeah.
We have to dote on her. I mean, I just gave her her special drops. She needed this thing called TPLO surgery, which is like dog ACL surgery on both legs.
Okay, yeah.
And there was a period of time where we had to put a gate around the couch so the dog wouldn't jump on the couch. And so we had to lecture our daughter like, okay, don't do this, don't do that. So she still is, she's like our fragile queen still.
Right.
And 15 years old, you've gotten what kind of dog is it?
So to me, she looks like a Border Terrier mix. When we've done the dog genetic testing, because of course.
Of course.
Both times it said she isn't a terrier at all. She's half purebred Shih Tzu, and then half the other side is like Chihuahua.
A huge mix.
Husky. like a bunch of things. And terrier's not on there at all, but she looks like a Border Terrier.
Very interesting.
Oh, wow.
Very interesting. We have a Yorkie, which we've had all kinds of dogs, but the Yorkie is certainly, I think, the most intelligent and the most obnoxious at the same time. Love her to death, but she just, they talk. That's what they do. They talk. And when you're talking, they want to talk. And when someone else, you know, when you're having a conversation, they want to be involved in it. What I like about your special, what I also found relatable about your dog conversation is when you're, accountant or business manager, you know, told you needed to get dog insurance. My dog has also had that surgery, and it saved our financial lives because we would have been in ruin had we not had that insurance, which paid back like 90% of the cost of the insurance, worth every penny.
Yes, this year she is finally, I think we came to the conclusion she's old enough to where her yearly fee, we did the math, is officially going to be higher than any medical bills. So I think we might be leaving insurance just because it doesn't, they won't insure.
I know. Yeah, we're getting to that point also with
how old's your dog?
Well, our dog just turned 10, but the way that they calculate it for certain breeds, we had a price hike last year, but then now, like, I think when they get to a 12, there's some kind of crazy price hike, which all of a sudden it just, okay, we're not going to do that. But then at 12 years old, too, you have to start thinking if it's serious about the quality of life of the dog. And so we'll just figure it out.
You'll know when you know.
Yeah,
when it
with our luck, that dog will be 20. Oh, yeah. That dog will outlive me. We'll have it in the. I'll have it in the retirement with any luck.
I love looking up facts about the oldest dogs because it gives me so much
comfort,
joy, and hope.
Yeah.
So the oldest dog in the world just died. He was a dog in Portugal named Bubby.
Aww.
And after my friend Allison, she was living in Portugal during the pandemic and her dog had just died and she made a pilgrimage to go meet Bobby. And she got close with Bobby and Bobby's owner and she went to Bobby's, I want to say actually it was Bobby's maybe 32nd birthday and then Bobby passed away soon after.
Wow.
32 years
old. Either 31 or 32. So, I mean,
There's hope. But, you know, but my dog, like your dog, is puking up all over the place. So I just don't know what's going on. Dog puke is the worst, too. I got to be honest.
Although, here's what I'll say. It doesn't smell.
That's
human puke. My daughter had like a 12-hour stomach bug the other night where she puked four times in one night. Human puke is actually, I think, the worst smell because you're not supposed to smell it.
Yes.
Like it's something that's inside, at least with poop, like, no, your body's supposed to make the poop. The poop is supposed to come out, you know, poop is not good, but like, at least it's supposed to, there's a hole just for the poop to come out. That's not what your mouth is for.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there's something with vomit that inherently is like, this is wrong.
Yes.
We have transgressed, you know, it's Jurassic Park. It's like the hubris of man. Yeah. What have you done? You've taken the insides and made them outside.
You might be right about this. Evolution-wise, we are actually trained to smell the our own stink coming out of our rear ends, right? But we are not trained. It is not in our DNA or in our, I guess, genetic makeup to know what, or to be pleasantly, I don't want to say pleasant, but that puke smell, to me, I agree with you.
It makes you want to throw up.
Puke is the worst smell in the world. And then when they put that orange shit on top of it, like when you go to a school or a Walmart or whatever, and they have
like
the emergency.
The sawdust or whatever?
Yeah, the sawdust. It just doesn't do anything for the smell. It just makes it twice as bad. I understand you got to clean it up, but could we not scent it also? Because now you're just mixing the orange with the puke. It's absolutely disgusting. How old is your daughter?
Five.
She's 5 years old.
Aww.
Yeah, that 12-hour stomach bug. Is that the kind where it just comes out all of a sudden? Like you're
It was like a shot. And the thing is, she didn't know the word for nauseous yet. That's how little she's thrown up in her life. And so she kept trying to go to sleep. She was exhausted. And she kept saying, oh no, the burp feeling is happening. And I was like, oh yeah, it does feel like you have to take a super burp and then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's so sad.
I know.
Yeah.
I feel so bad for
it's
them.
The worst. I have a number of small children, and one time they got that 12-hour bug, but they got it within minutes of each other, and my wife was out for the night. So one of them started throwing up in the bed, and then when I carried him to the shower as he was throwing up all over me and everybody else, one of my daughters walked in, gray as she could be, and then she just said, Daddy, but the word didn't make it out, and it was...
Oh. Yeah.
And... As my wife was, Rachel, it was a night I will never forget. Number one, because I honestly just have a phobia of puke, and now it's all over me and all over everything. But second of all, I've got two of these things now running around just puking, and they also don't have the words. They don't have the knowledge. They don't understand. They don't know why you're taking them to the toilet. They don't know to go to the toilet. It was a whole thing. And but these are the things we learn as we're growing up as parents. Learning.
That is disgusting. That's how old were they?
One of them was 3 and one of them was 2 at the time. So
that's too young. They don't even know what they just don't know what's going on.
No, they're scared. They get scared. Yeah, and so now you have to calm them down. Yeah. Because they don't know why all of this is coming out of them or what's going on.
Yeah, and your body's doing it. Like I felt when I was feeling, I was like rubbing her back as she was puking and like it feels very adult. I don't know what other way. Like you feel the gurgle of the vomit and it's like her body is doing a very grown up thing of like, we need to get this out.
Yeah.
And they're like, the demon seed. What is this?
The demon seed. All right. Now that we've ruined everyone's breakfast. So your daughter, this special that you put together for Netflix, which I think is imaginative, heartfelt, extremely funny, very creative, really well done. I think it's
Thank you.
A point on it. You're welcome. The special starts out, and I don't think I'm ruining anything for anybody who hasn't seen it. The special starts out with a voicemail you're leaving somebody. Hey, I think this COVID thing is not going to go away, so maybe we just need to postpone the special. We'll do it when all this settles down. And then you fast forward to 2023, I think it is, and then you're making the special. But a lot of life happened in between then for you. Is that was your daughter born during that time?
So my daughter was born. So like, my daughter was born in late March, 2020 and
and
the special is basically about, she was born, my daughter was born the night. So COVID was already happening. The night she was born, I found out that my songwriting partner had COVID, which I had no idea. And he was across the country in upstate New York. And then she was in the NICU, which we didn't expect happening because I had a normal pregnancy. But they also don't warn you that going to the NICU is actually rather common. About 10 to 15% of babies end up in the NICU. She was in the NICU for a breathing problem, which during a pandemic that affects the lungs was horrible. And
that's
then
weird. My child, too.
Yeah, it's very common. And then my writing partner died of COVID basically a week after she was born. So that's what the special's about.
Yes. And so that's crazy terrible. Was your writing partner young, older, or did he just get COVID and it just...
He was 52.
And it just
and had
was...
no pre-exist. He got... Can I curse on here?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
I was making sure. I don't know why
Thank
I got
you. No, head. I appreciate it.
He just got fucked. I mean, he was living in Manhattan. He got a full blast of it. And he just got fucked. Mm-hmm. Some people just got fucked.
Yeah.
Like
I, you know,
there was no rhyme or reason to some of the people who died very, very, especially very early on. Mm-hmm. There was no pre-existing condition you could blame it on. There was nothing. He wasn't a smoker. Like he just got fucked.
Yeah, he just got fucked. And I think I agree with you is that early on, I mean, I think we're all still in a little bit of a daze about all this. And I do think it will take generations maybe to put any perspective that makes any sense. But early on, there's no pathology. There's no, everyone's confused. No one knows what to do. When you are having your daughter, Chrissy and I are starting this show.
Yeah, my mom had just passed away too that
Her
March.
Mom had just passed away. And just remember that kind of fog of war thing. Like, oh, this will go away in a couple weeks. You know, or hopefully this will die down.
Yeah.
And then in May or April and May, realizing, holy shit, I've got children. Mm-hmm. I've got a pregnant wife. Like for me, I've got a pregnant wife. And now everything's locked down. Everyone's acting differently. The world kind of seems to be on edge and going crazy. I think this special seems to be like really revealing in a way, I imagine, but you tell me, that the whole special changed. Like everything changes.
That was the origin. I mean, I was going to do a special. Basically, I'd been working on a special that was just kind of stand up into songs. And then the inspiration for it was I was with my daughter at 5 a.m. one day, and she was 2 or 3 months old. And I, in my office, I had this whiteboard where I break down, I was breaking down what the special would be, kind of stand-up bits into songs, and I looked at it and I thought, this is so stupid. And then I started thinking, like, oh, what if there's a special about that, about the trying to stick with silliness despite the world going tits up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like how I got to thinking about it. And I've thought about this a lot in general, about the world getting horrible. And the more you read about, I mean, I'm not a historian, but the more I learn about history, it seems as if the human experience is actually more chaos and disease and war and economic collapse than it isn't. And I think that for I feel a connection with Gen X I never had before, because I feel like for Gen Xers and millennials and boomers for the most part, it was a period, especially in America, of relative, I mean, the late 60s were horrific.
Sure.
But so I guess I'm talking more like the 70s and 80s, 90s for the most part. Mm-hmm. It's this period of kind of tranquility. They call the 90s the end of history for a reason. And the more I read about history, I'm anomaly, periods of tranquility.
Hey, Rachel.
The late 90s, but yeah.
Can repeat that last sentence, because for some reason you just froze. Up. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Look at that. I have a pretty stable internet connection.
Yeah, we do too. But sometimes it happens, you know. Just repeat that last sentence if you would.
The more you read about history, the human history seems more often than not on instability.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think that, and this is me, I only know what, you know, my own life, but I think that, and I don't know if you caught this, but they called the 90s something like the end of history.
Yes, I've read that before, yeah.
It felt like, we wrapped it all up. It's the end of the movie, right?
Yeah.
And I think, as opposed to the way that boomers, Gen Xers, millennials grew up, especially in this country, for the bulk of our lives, that's what we thought life was. And I think that that's actually not what life is for most human beings and most of human history. It is trauma. It is disease. It is war, unfortunately. And so I think that that's what I'm still reeling from. And I think that generationally, a bunch of us are reeling from is like the look of shock I see on someone's face who's 20 years older than I am is the same as mine.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. it was, you come up, like part of the whole, you know, Gen Z thing of like, don't be a sellout, don't try so hard, is you have the luxury of being able to say that when the world is in relative calm and relative peace, and you can be disenchanted with suburbia.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not saying this on a personal level. I was miserable in the late 90s, but the world wasn't.
Yeah.
Fair enough. True story. Yeah, and I think if you grew up in the 90s like I did, like Chrissy did, and you reflect on that time, it really was a time of prosperity mm-hmm. and tranquility, at least here in the United States, right? There's always strife somewhere in the world. But here in the United States, our experience was largely that of a drama-free existence, because there are, in history, there are a lot of, and I'm not a historian either, but there's so much strife and pestilence and disease and war, and we're always struggling with, like, fighting against ourselves or fighting against other human beings. And until COVID hit, I think all of us who had been alive since this period of time, you know, born in the 70s or 80s or 90s, had been life was relatively easy, so to speak. And we go through this one hiccup and the entire fabric, it felt like at that moment, just kind of tore apart. And I see so many people, we still see it, have been affected by this, and they haven't kind of picked themselves. Mm-hmm. They haven't repaired that. It's not there. It's gone. And so did you feel like this? How were you feeling in that moment? Your partner dies. You have a new daughter. The world is locked down. What is your just like general sense of well-being at that point? Are you just, I mean, I don't know. I can share
just
my
trying
own
to hang
experience.
On. I mean, yeah. I think just trying
I think
to hang
everybody
on.
Was,
I think
yeah.
shock. Just trying to parent, you know, while living in relative isolation. trying to find the joy. I mean, that's what I realized is I've always valued comedy and joy. But I will say the reliance in a wonderful way that I had on things that made me laugh.
Mm.
TV shows, movies, books. Like I went back to these old, I have these anthologies of The Onion.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I just would go back that's and reread great. Those. And it was, I would try to work this into the special. It never quite worked. But the idea that laughter, for a moment you defy death because you feel the weight of the world suddenly feels lighter.
Mm.
And so laughing in the face of death, even making death a joke, it conquers it for a brief moment.
That's
and
so
that is what helped me. And now when people say, I was always really honored when people said, oh, I watched, you know, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which was my TV show.
Mm-hmm.
I watched it.
Great show, by the way.
During a hard moment in my life, I would always be really touched. But now I really get it because I'm like, that's the stuff that keeps you sane.
Yeah. Yes.
It's actually not frivolous entertainment. And I think that it took me a while to realize that because when I looked at that whiteboard of my special, right, with all the stand-up bits and songs, the thought that I had was, this is so stupid. But then in retrospect, the thing that continued to get me through was stupidity, was jokes, was little moments of idiocy. And without that, you would drown.
Yes.
You would die. And it actually, I think that silliness, it's why my special, and I don't want to spoil it too much, but like my special begins on a dumb song and then a bunch of stuff happens where I'll just spoil it. There's a heckler in the audience, but it's not a heckler. It's Death personified, played by my friend David Hall. And Death is saying, you're not being honest. Talk about me. Talk about me. But then after, so there's a whole arc of the show where I talk about Death, and then the show ends with the same silly song. And the reason it does is because if it's almost like if nothing matters, why not this song about trees that smell like cum?
Yes.
And what if trees that smell like cum and that stupid song about it is the point of the universe?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that was, it's something I still think about.
I think it's a beautiful point made, and it's something that I believe. I lean more toward it the older that I get, the more that we do this show, the more that I get text messages that say, well, let me back up for a second. We used to do this show and you talk into the void. You have a microphone. No one's responding to you. It's not like when you get on stage in front of 1,000 people and they respond instantly to whatever is going on. It's a little bit more of a lonely venture. It's a less brave venture, but it's maybe a little less noble, but it's a lonely venture. You talk and then maybe somebody texts or calls or whatever. But then sometimes we'll get a text message or of email and it'll say, hey, I was having a really hard time. Remember one specific guy said, I'm going through a divorce. My wife took the kids. I'm really having a hard time. I was in a really bad place. I found your show and I'm a truck driver. I've just been listening to it for the last 2 days, all your episodes. And I got to say, it may have saved my life. And I thought that's a really big statement. But I think that the broader point that I'm feeling and leaning more toward as I get older is that life is really about these kind of beautiful moments of creativity. It's where God is found. God is, you know, there's a lot of things we'll never understand. There's a lot of pain. There's a lot of strife, a lot of struggle. But these momentary moments, almost like moments of silence with laughter or with a song or with a movie that you enjoy or a lover that you have or whatever it is, these moments where God comes in and gives us brief respite from this suffering is the whole fucking shebang. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's what we're supposed to recognize, is that these are the moments, these moments when you're laughing, these moments when you're creating something that someone else is laughing, God's coming through you and giving those people, and I say God, you know, however you want to say it or believe it, but God's coming through you and giving others and yourself like this brief moment of respite, and that is what it's all about. And healing happens there, and love happens there, and beauty happens there, and sometimes sadness happens there. But I think comedy can be a real healing force as well as a driving force for a lot of other things. But I think it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And I think it's beautiful what you did with your special, because you must have felt a lot of pain writing that special. And going through it and going through the motions and figuring it out. Was it cathartic for you?
Yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of the emotions, I didn't start writing the special until, I don't know, a little bit of time had passed. I mean, there was a period of time where I really couldn't look at photos of Adam.
No, I can't imagine. Yeah.
And we were also still in the thick of the pandemic, so there was no live performance. Mm-hmm. And because I started working it out live, like the first time I think I had the special idea for maybe a little bit. And then the first stand-up show I did, even coming back, was May 2021. Mm. So by the time I really started talking about it, because there was no live performance, about a year had passed. The thing the show forced me to do, because I had grieved and I was still grieving, but it forced me to make sense of that grief and think about the kind of what now. Mm-hmm. Okay, I grieved. I went through this thing. What do I do with all of this? How does it affect the way I see the world? How do I not let this completely poison the way I see the world? So that's what it helped me do. And that's what writing generally helps me do, is it helps me think and work out how I feel about things. Because in writing, you have to, you know, you're solving a driving question, writing on a theme. You have to know what the thing you're saying is in order to make a coherent piece for everyone else. And so it forces you to figure out some sort of conclusion, some sort of thing, because you have to communicate your insides to the outside, back to vomit. Really,
yeah. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is a great show. Where did that come from? Like, what is this come? Where does this come from in your place in your head? It's a great show. And, as the title says, you know, we all have one, but where does this come from? Where does this come from? Where did Crazy Ex-Girlfriend come from?
Well, I was doing music videos on my YouTube.
Yep.
Most of which were pop satires that were also very much about my, you know, being vulnerable emotionally, or I basically like doing cool genres in a very uncool way. And my writing partner, Aline Brosh McKenna, was procrastinating and saw one of my videos and started watching my videos and then said, "Do you want to get together and talk about creating a musical TV show?" And that's how it happened.
Mm.
Was that an easy pitch? It's an easy pitch to go in and say, "I want to do a musical dramedy." Like, I just can imagine that Hollywood in general poo-poos the idea.
Here's the thing. So, couple things. We pitched it in 2014, which is the start of, you'd say, I guess you could argue mid beginning of peak TV.
Yeah.
So people were very open to things. Also, there were so many more places to pitch. Mm-hmm. Here are the places we pitched: AMC, MTV, IFC, Comedy Central, Amazon.
Oh my gosh.
FX, Netflix, HBO. I might be forgetting one either, right?
Wow.
So a lot of those places are not
in existence.
Like, there's anymore. No MTV anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't think Comedy Central's doing shows like this anymore. So there were also just, there was a lot more hope.
Yeah.
A lot more shows were getting made. And Aline Brosh McKenna, who is about 20 years my senior, she is a big deal screenwriter. She wrote The Devil Wears Prada. People had been wanting her to do TV for many years. So walking in with her, having co-created the show with her and this premise, was very different than had I created the show with someone more on my career mm-hmm. level, someone, you know, burgeoning YouTube star. I mean, sure. I was never like a huge YouTube star, but like, you know, cult YouTube star just starting out. Like, she walked into rooms and
people paid attention.
There were a couple people who were prepared to buy it just to work with her. Mm-hmm. So that really worked in our favor. But we were a Showtime pilot. I mean, another buyer that's now just a tile on Paramount Plus, right? We sold it to Showtime. We made the pilot with Showtime. Showtime passed. So we had a dead pilot. And then Aline watched Jane the Virgin mm-hmm. on the CW and was like, "Oh, the CW is doing really interesting shit. And that's how we got our series. We were CW series. So it was a combination of a bunch of things. And then it's why I got asked a question a couple weeks ago of like, oh my God, you did such daring things on the show. How did you do that? And it's like, that's not, I mean, yes, I'm very proud of the show, but plenty of people in life want to do daring things, but they just don't have someone backing them.
Yeah.
We had a network who let us do pretty much whatever we wanted.
They were super supportive of the concept. They were there. Mm-hmm.
They kept renewing the show. Yeah. They paid for the show. I mean, that's the odds of that happening are so incredibly small. And that's just luck. I mean, I would say fortune. Luck is a hard word because luck implies that you didn't, you know,
you
do
didn't
anything
earn
for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I will say the further I get out of having a show that aired 2015 to 2019, I'm like, no, that was luck. To be in that period of television, that's pure luck.
Yeah, you hit it, and now it's we talk about this all the time with everybody who comes on the show, how the streamers have fundamentally changed the way that everybody behaves and acts around the creation of content. It's just the way that it is. The streamers and YouTube and podcasting, quite frankly, have changed the landscape of media in general. So you did. So how did you meet your writing partner on that show? How did you meet her?
No, it was, she saw my
She just, like, literally in just reached out to you?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is amazing. Did you freak out?
I was very excited. I didn't want to get my hopes up.
Yeah.
And I was almost so, I knew what a big deal it was. I almost was like, okay, calm down.
Yeah.
I had a lot of anxiety issues I hadn't worked out then too. So I think part of my way of dealing with anxiety was to, I don't know, ignore it or downplay it or whatever. But yeah, no, it was a huge deal.
Yeah. So luck, but someone who knew good content, knew that there was someone out there who could help, mm-hmm. you know, boost a project, young and up and coming talent, took a chance on you. And you're right about that. I think about this as a content creator. You need somebody in your corner, mm-hmm. right? It's so hard at any given time, but especially these days, it's so hard to get noticed, to make a move, to get ahead, to cut through the mustard, whatever you want to say. It's so lovely to have somebody that's in your corner. If you find
your
that
champion.
Person
yeah.
that is willing to say, I like what you're doing and I'm willing to help you get it out there or whatever it is. That's
and
a blessing.
And more as we leave a monoculture, there are fewer and fewer people who can have that power and really do that.
Yeah.
And again, it's just a right place, right time thing. Look, what I'll say is I've been busting my ass on those music videos for a while. I've been busting my ass. I've been often spending my own money. I continue to bust my ass. Like, I have two TV pilots right now that I busted my ass on that I'm waiting to hear about. Behind me on this whiteboard are a bunch of new stand-up bits and songs. Like, I am proud that I value hard work and I value people who work hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I have to believe for my own sanity that busting one's ass does pay off in some way. However, also knowing that there are many people around me who are, amazingly hard workers who haven't sold a show. And so all you can do is work hard. And I almost think it's kind of, you have to at this point, if you're and this is a very specific thing, if you're a working writer who is, especially for TV and film, who is selling things, who has the good fortune to be selling things, that you have to almost, in a meditative way, see that as the goal.
Yeah.
That I get to write for a mm-hmm. living, because getting things made, the odds are so small. And that's why YouTube and TikTok are so great, because there's no gatekeeper.
Yeah.
You can bypass a gatekeeper. And that's why I always go back to live performance, frankly, because TikTok and YouTube, you're still, you know, editing in a room and you're putting it out. And the way that you get audience feedback is by looking at comments, which you shouldn't do.
No. Right?
Never.
So that's the problem is that we strive to create and connect with people, and you get that on a film set. And you even get that in a group editing room. But if you're on your own with TikTok, I think there's a little bit of and when I was doing YouTube videos, there's a little bit of solitude with that, right?
Yes.
Of you want the feedback. Live performance, I will never, ever, ever stop doing live performance because it is a way to reach an audience directly in front of you without a gatekeeper.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And the feedback is instant, right? The feedback is instant and you can position and pivot. And if you're good, then you know how to, you know, take something that's not working and massage it and get it better. Being on stage in front of people, is that the favorite, is your favorite version of creating?
Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, I really love, I would say also like the whole process of creating TV is really wonderful because it is so communal between a writer's room to table reads to being on set with other people. Mm-hmm. That's every day of work is that little kind of slice of joy. It's a different joy. But live performing, just people are so, they're right in front of you and they're real and they're not behind a keyboard and they're not, I don't know, they're not judgmental in the same ways.
Mm-hmm. It's so, it's
at least
so
the shows
true.
I do. I mean, I was never a club comic playing places where they would, you know, throw beer bottles at you. So I do, you know, indie comedy shows or my own shows where people are primed to be a bit kinder. But yeah, it just, it's human and it's healing. And for how polarized the world is, getting in front of people is just, it is and remains extremely healing for many, many things.
Yeah. I also think when you do content and you put it out for free, it's kind of, you know, you get what you pay for from the creator side. And that is the feedback. Never look at the comments, but of course you look at the comments. And
you crave something. I mean, that is what's lonely about it, right? Is like the whole reason you make art is to connect with people.
Yeah.
And that's why I think, I don't know, I have very mixed feelings about the internet and social media, despite the fact I started-ish on YouTube, is you create art to make a connection, but, and I'm not the first person to say, this is not a hot take, but, you know, the internet is fundamentally, it's false connection, right? It's a disconnected connection.
Yes.
There is nothing that can replace interacting with a human being in real time. There just isn't. And it's something that I'm still navigating and working through. And I have a daughter, like, I don't want her on social media.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want her as a teenager. Mm. I mean, this is a far off problem, but like, you know, do I leave to set an example for her when she turns 13? Do I just peace out and leave Instagram and just hope that I get shit made through film and TV? And live performance? I don't know.
This is the biggest question that for me as a parent that is always omnipresent, all the small shit, all the little shit, just getting them physically, making sure that they don't kill themselves physically, is for their own mental health. Mm-hmm. How do I navigate this world of access to digital media when we already know, just this little bit in, we already know just how incredibly dangerous it is, speaking of mental health, for our mental health. Full-grown-ass adults who have heads directly on their shoulders get taken down by the stuff that happens online. And it's a disconnected connection because some people, it just really feeds this side of them where they become little keyboard shitheads, right? And they say and do anything that they want to because there is no repercussions on the internet. And that's a scary place to be. And the bullying and the la, 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 la. It's so fucking scary. And then you're raising children in that environment. Mm-hmm. And they already, and I'm sure you're experiencing this too, already at a young age are wondering what that is. And you're just trying to protect them. You're saying, hey, listen, don't be in a hurry to grow up. You know, it's really scary. Are you already experiencing that?
No, she doesn't really clock. Luckily, she doesn't. We don't watch a ton of YouTube.
No, YouTube is a no-no in my house.
Like the way that it is in my house is we watch TV
yes.
shows. And so I haven't really turned her on to like those influencery unboxing videos things. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just not, I guess it's just not what my husband and I want. I don't know. I don't know how. She'll probably find it when she goes to elementary school next year. No, I mean, the thing that she thinks the internet is the source of A, information, where I'll look something up, or it's a way for her to buy things. Yeah. And so that's what she does know, is like, I want a sparkly skirt. Go. Order it now.
Yeah.
Order it right now. When will it be here? So that's and I dread the day that she realizes she could order this.
She can do it herself.
Yeah. Alexa. Yeah. She hasn't realized that yet.
My son
when
has.
She was a, yeah. When she was a, when I was still pregnant, we played around with the Alexa, and in like a baby voice, we're like, Alexa, order me a 1,000 boxes of cereal. And Alexa was like, 1,000 boxes of cereal. We're like, oh
no, shit. It's coming.
So the day she has not yet, because I've never ordered anything vocally with Alexa on purpose, because I'm, once she realizes she can do that, the
it's game over.
Yeah.
It's game over.
So no, she's not aware yet.
Yeah.
She's not super aware. And I have to say, I don't get recognized like a ton, but when I do, I always worried about it being weird for her, because I didn't grow up in this industry at all. And so the idea of like having people come up to my parents, I don't know what that would have been. But she's fine with it. It's either she doesn't care, or she's like, oh yeah, I'm proud of my mommy too. Thank you. Like,
yeah.
It's not weird. It's not weird or jarring for her. And I don't put her on social. I don't put her on my social media at all.
No.
So I'm not like, sweetie, say hello to the fans.
Right.
You
know?
You are incredibly smart, Rachel. And well, I follow the same program.
Well, because also like, you can't, it's why like I'm being, you can't close the box on something, right? So like, I haven't even shared her name publicly.
Yeah.
There's a lot, and it's not even like that, will I eventually share more about her? Yeah, I will. And like, I've posted pictures of like the side of her face. It's just that you can't close that box.
Yeah.
And the AI shit of, I mean, I do clear at the airport, right? Where it goes, we have finished taking pictures of your eyes.
Yes.
Like, I'm trying to keep her out of the system for as long as possible, theoretically, so that it's her choice.
Yeah. Yes.
Again, I don't know. This is it's an imperfect science, right? Like, I'm in the new Angry Birds movie, which will be coming out in like January 2027.
Oh my God.
That's
right.
Huge.
There will be a premiere for that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to bring her to that premiere.
Yeah.
Will she want to do a red carpet? I don't know. Will she be in public pictures from that premiere? Maybe. I can't completely block her from things. It's weird. It's imperfect. I'm figuring it out.
Yeah.
And I just, her safety and well-being is, and happiness is the most important.
It's paramount thing to me. Yeah.
Like, I could be pimping her out and getting a lot of free shit.
Yeah.
It's true. And
that's
a lot
of parents
that
I remind her of every day. I'm like, you know, if I wanted, I could get everything free.
Yeah.
And I don't.
It's like that little kid on YouTube. He's making, you know, what is it, $92 million a year unboxing videos, whatever his name is. It's crazy.
It's not, fame is not, and I say this as someone who is marginally cult famous. Fame is not a normal, it's not a normal state of.
No, it's not.
No.
And luckily I started in a comedy theater. I'm still doing comedy where the work comes first. Right.
Yeah.
I think there are very few kids and teenagers who can actually have a measured view of themselves from getting wildly famous. I'm friends with Mara Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
I went to school with her. She has a very good view of it. Like, she's incredibly smart, has a very good perspective about it. Auditioning as a kid was kind of always her choice.
Yeah.
I think that's rare. And this is a larger thing of like the ethics of, like, I love what they do on Bluey, that they haven't even released those kids' names. I think it's so cool. The ethics of putting anyone whose brain is not fully formed in a spotlight it seems like this very, very weird experiment. Yeah. That's been going on for hundreds of years.
Mozart
was a famous prodigy when he was like seven. So it's going to happen. Kids are going to get famous, but I don't know. I think about this.
Yeah, but the difference is that Mozart, in his time, could be famous for about 10 square miles. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it wasn't like, I mean, I guess that's all relative because his 10 square miles were his 10 square miles, but I totally get it. And it's an experiment that I think my wife and I choose not to share the names. We don't put them on social media. You know, we have a Facebook page that's closed to just our family and friends. We have a sharing app if people want to see pictures that are invited to that sharing app. And we just want to keep it secret. We want to keep it their choice for as long as possible, as much as possible. And when they're old enough and have their own principles about them or their own desires and wishes, then we can say, if you choose and it's age appropriate, then okay, then you can. You can do that. What's next for Rachel? What are we looking forward to doing? I'm sorry. I know you got to go. I just want to be sensitive to your time.
I have what's next for me is you are catching me on a day where I am in a holding pattern with two different TV scripts.
Oh,
am currently at the mercy. Both of them with the Greater Walt Disney Company.
Oh, come on, Disney. Come through, Disney.
It was what it is.
Yeah,
So this is the first year in a while where I don't know what the rest of my year looks like, actually. Mm-hmm.
Scary or is it okay with you? Or both?
It's both. I mean, luckily, they're jobs that have still paid, right? So I'm not worried about like, I might get this. I've completed both of these jobs that were factored into my budget for the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's more like, what does the rest of my year look like?
Yeah.
And it's exciting. It's scary. There's a different level of uncertainty when you have a kid.
Yep. Yeah.
Of course.
Of course.
Also with our industry, everything is leaving Los Angeles, leaving the United States.
Yes.
So it's like, okay, at a certain point, when do those choices come in? You know, when do I schlep my kid off to Romania or not take a job in
it's
Romania? I haven't been offered a job. I haven't been offered a job in Romania, but it's going to get more. This is her last year of preschool. I'm fucking off and taking her to Disneyland tomorrow. Cause I'm like, oh, my best friend's in town. I'm like, let's beat the crowds. When they hit kindergarten, you can't take them out of school.
Like, no, then the truancy cop shows up.
Exactly.
And then you got all different animals.
You're catching me at a very specific time. I think a year from now, I don't know. We'll see.
Well, Rachel, you're extraordinarily talented. We're very grateful for your time. Thank you for joining us on the 12 Hours. You have been very transparent, funny, and creative about how you have talked about your own challenges and struggles and hurdles as a human being in general, but then more specifically over the last couple of years. And I'm going to put links in the show notes, especially to her Netflix special, which I think everybody should go and watch because I think it's really fantastic.
Thank you.
And you're welcome back anytime. Rachel Bloom.
Yes. Good luck for your on your new projects, too.
Yes. May Disney come through. If you want me to call Bob, let me know.
No, it's fine. It's not. They're fine.
No, I'm
kidding. Doing great.
Yeah, but as a guy who has 5 shares of the Walt Disney Company, let me.
Yeah. They'll listen.
Yes, let me roll over on Bob and see if we can get this done.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. One Rachel. Down. So many to go.
Rachel was great.
Rachel's great. I like Rachel Bloom. Can color me a fan, Chrissy. Color me a fan. And color me a 5-hour energy. Pop one of those open. Episode number 2 in the books. 2 of however many we can manage to get through today.
Yep.
Anyway, all of Rachel Bloom's information is in the show notes. So please go visit, follow, like, subscribe, all that good stuff to all of Rachel's stuff. It begs a rewatch of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, I think, Chrissy.
I think so, too. Yes. I really like that show.
And let's hope she gets that new show so we can all be graced with the writing genius that is Rachel Bloom. I like how she said that the world ended in 1990, or like humanity reached its peak humanness in 1990.
Yes.
I think I might agree with her.
I think so too, maybe. Maybe that's why everything 90s is new again.
Maybe that's why everyone really wants the 90s. Bring Bill Clinton back. Okay, yeah. So he got a blowjob. All right.
Right, that seems like nothing.
That seems so, nothing. So insignificant. I mean, except for the poor girl who got lambasted, you know, through the media, through all that drama.
Of course.
What was her name?
Monica Lewinsky.
Monica Lewinsky. I'm so sorry. This is a long time ago. We reached our peak then. I'm done. I'm over with. Anyway, except for Monica getting a shit on really badly, I would have to say that a blowjob in the Oval Office doesn't sound like that big of a deal anymore.
I know. It really does. Bring those days back.
Please. Arsenio Hall, Conan at 12:30, Dave Letterman on at 11:30, Bill Clinton in office, prosperity for everyone. Pearl Jam on the radio.
Brunch.
We're all going back to the retirement home. All right, Rachel Bloom, all of her links in the show notes. Episode number 2 of TCB's Endless Day, sponsored by 5-Hour Energy in the can. Thanks to Bella at CTV for making all of this guesting happen. She's the magician behind all of the guests here on the commercial break. We love her, love her, love her. And all the people over at CTV.
Love you, Bella.
Love you, Bella. All right, we're going to try and go live here in a couple of hours. Make sure you're following us on Instagram for all of that information. You've got all of the details, 212-433-3TCB at The Commercial Break on Instagram, youtube.com/TheCommercialBreak. This episode with Rachel Bloom is now live on YouTube. Okay, we will see you back here at the top of the hour, hopefully. Chrissy, until the next episode a few minutes away, I love you.
I love you.
Best to you.
And best to you.
And best to you out there in the podcast universe. Until the next episode, we will say, we do say, and we must say.
Goodbye.